obviously. I just wanted to draw your attention, and I can in fact make this black for a moment, to something which is quite important and which may have an impact on quite a few of you. So it is something that I would recommend that you have a look at. There is a junior professorship about to be filled. The position is to be filled soon, for next semester already. And this is a junior professorship which will be either in Germanistik or in Anglistik. It depends on the candidate. We have five candidates who are coming to give us a trial lecture, and two of them are from English, and three of them are from German, from Germanistik. And after each presentation, your student representatives will ask you for feedback. For that reason, it is actually quite important that there are more people than just the two representatives in the committee, because they would really like to have your feedback on whether you would like to be taught by that person or not. Okay. They take place on the Monday and the Tuesday after the break, in the afternoon. They will be in German, but those two people, no, wait a minute. This person here, Dr. Hashimi Yakani and Dr. Julia Roth, will be the candidates for English. Okay. So please come and attend those lectures. They might be simply interesting, but they might be also very interesting for you because you might be able to attend further lectures and courses by these people. Okay. All right, any questions about this? Oops. So, this is how... Hello? Yes, okay. Can you see this? Sufficient? Good. Right, today's lecture. I'd like to talk about the lexicon today, the words that we use, but of course from a historical perspective as well. I'll briefly mention aspects of word formation again, but really only very briefly. This is not supposed to be a retake or a redo of the first year lecture. I'll say just a few words about the lexicon and register, in how far individual words can be seen to have a connection with register. And then the second part of the lecture will be on semantic change. Okay. In particular, I'll be giving you the classical story of what people consider to be the different types of semantic change. And then towards the end, I'd like to concentrate a little bit, but it will only really touch on this a little bit, on whether semantic change is actually something regular or not. This leads over to the next lecture, which isn't going to be for a couple of weeks. We're only meeting in 3 weeks' time. And there I will be talking about mechanisms of language change and also about syntactic language change. And in fact, some of the things that I'll be saying at the end of the lecture, I'll continue saying or I'll build up on at the beginning of the following lecture. The other thing that I'd like to say towards the end of the lecture is what the assignment is going to be. Because remember, if you are a sixth semester student, you will be required to do an assignment. I will upload this today after the lecture. I'd like to say a few things because you need to do something for the extra 2 credit points that you receive for those, for this work. Okay, but that's at the end. And looking at the number of slides and looking at how things go, you might be able to leave a few minutes early into the nice evening. We'll see how it goes. I never quite know in advance. Okay, the lexicon. The words we use. Okay, not the lexicon in terms of a book or something like that, but the lexicon, the mental lexicon, that's available to us, in our native language, but also, of course, when we speak English, which it is for most of us, which is not a native language. The lexicon, yes, people have made statements like this. that looking at the language, we can actually find out a lot about the history of the language. History is a language net cast backwards, was something that was said by one person. Or something very similar, in a bit of a longer quote, it has only just begun, this is from 1926, so this is an old quote, it has only just begun to dawn on us that in our own language alone, not to speak of its many, many companions, the past history of humanity is spread out in an imperishable map, just as the history of the mineral earth lies embedded in the layers of its outer crust. So in other words, if we look at the kind of language that we have today, if we look at the kind of words that we use and the lexicon that we have at our disposal today, it's basically some kind of fossilization of much of the history of English and the changes that I've already briefly outlined in the first few lectures. So it's worth looking at this in a little bit more detail. First, a few comments about the size of the lexicon. Okay. How many words does English have? 100,000? 500,000? 1,000,000? Too many, I think someone said. Okay, or a lot in any case. Clearly, English has a very large lexicon. There are many words in English, many more words in other languages, partly because of the as a result of the history of English through the kind of diglossic or triglossic situation that we had in the Middle Ages, and many of those words then sort of went their own ways. Okay. What's the answer to a question like that? As always in linguistics, it depends. Yes. It depends on how you count. It depends on what you count as a word, and many of you will probably remember the first year lecture on words and the difficulties that you have in defining what a word is, depending on how you count. Okay. One important distinction that I drew there was the distinction between lexemes or lemmas, some people prefer lemmas, versus word forms. Okay. One lexeme can have several different word forms by way of inflectional morphology. So sing, sang, sang, sung, singing, all these ones are different word forms of the same word, in a way. Well, not word, but lemma or lexeme. And we would count them, I guess, as a single item in order to assess the size of the lexicon. That's in a way straightforward and easy. But things become a little bit more difficult when you look at other ways of creating words. We all know the prefix un, happy, unhappy. Are these two different words? Very often in a dictionary, you will find words like this under one single entry, or rather, you will find an entry for the prefix un, and the idea is that you can then sort of productively attach it to different words, and it doesn't need a dictionary entry for each individual un something. Okay. So there are good reasons to say that in a way it's the same word but with a very productive prefix attached to it. But what do you do with something like this? Easy and uneasy. Quite clearly, we're not talking about the same word here. These are two different words because something that's easy is not the opposite of something that's uneasy. Uneasy doesn't mean difficult. Huh? So here we're really talking about a difference in the meaning of the words, in the semantics of the words, that are not simply related to the morphological makeup, okay, that are not transparent, but that really are, more different in that way, okay, and difference in meaning. Okay, but whether you draw the difference, whether you draw the line, etc., that's why I said it depends. Some people have, of course, tried to estimate the size of the lexicon. Looking at Old English, which is difficult because we haven't got all that much left to look at, some people estimate that the total size of the lexicon could have been around 50 to 60,000. Okay. And many of them, will have been restricted, or it looks as if they have were restricted to poetry alone. Then, remember, we had the Scandinavian invasion, and they added some words. You see different numbers here. This is a fairly low number, but about 2,000 words would have been added, and we're talking about words that are still in existence today. Then we heard about the massive influx that was brought in through the Norman conquest, the Norman influence, which really sort of extended or added to the vocabulary quite dramatically. Estimates are 100,000 to 125,000 different words, so about a doubling from the Old English period. A further doubling of the size will have occurred in the Renaissance. Remember the period when the adornment of the language was deemed necessary, when people added words to reflect the fact that new elements of science or new areas of science were discovered, new things needed names, etc. But also the kind of creation of new words for the sake of creating new words that sounded difficult and therefore good. Okay, the Inkhorn controversy that I talked about. Today, maybe about 500,000 words, again, depending on how you count. It doesn't mean that the average person knows 500,000 words. Okay? It just basically means that these are available, possibly in the Oxford English Dictionary. There are, of course, many more terms for sciences like biology or chemistry, which can be put together on the basis of the chemical structure or the atomic makeup of things that would then perhaps also be called different words, but it doesn't really make sense to count them like that. Okay, that's an estimate. It's a lot. Yeah. Let's have a look at the British National Corpus. Remember, most of you will have heard this before, the British National Corpus is a 100 million, approximately 100 million word corpus of present-day English, containing spoken and written language, only 10% spoken. 100 million is quite a lot. Okay. How many different word forms, or no, not word forms, how many different lemmas do we have, or lexemes do we have in the BNC? 616,000. Okay. But half of them only occur once. Okay. They are what are, in that sense, in the corpus at least, I don't know whether you've heard the name before, so-called hapax legomena, okay, words that only occur once. One hapax legomenon, and these are hapax legomena, that are really words, I mean, every word starts as one, as a hapax legomenon, but they often, when they are reused, then obviously by definition no longer are a word that is used only once. But a lot of them only occur once, partly because of spelling or scanning mistakes and others, so it doesn't mean that these are, many of them are, most of them are actually real words, but quite a few of them are not. About 95,000 occur 10 or more times. Here we're talking about words that are in reasonable currency. Okay. And 27,000 occur at least 100 times. These are clearly not quite the basic stock of the lexicon, but they are clearly current enough to be called, well, straightforward members of the lexicon. Just to give you an idea of the words that are found only once in the BNC, here I've chosen words that are actually formed by way of adding a derivational prefix, mini-monster, mini-mosque, mini-nation, mini-note, mini-office, etc. The fact that they only happen once is accidental. We could easily imagine them occurring more often depending on the choice of texts, of course. They're also mostly transparent in terms of meaning, even though they are extremely infrequent. Most of them, the meaning is pretty much obvious. Okay, mini parliament. I don't know. I mean, well, it'll be a parliament that for some reason is very, very small. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mini print, mini prison, etc. Yeah, it's sort of mostly fairly straightforward. Okay, so we don't really know how many words, a lot, and that's got to do with the history of English, or the history of the English language. Now, how do we make new words? Well, we've got on the one hand word formation. We've seen one example of this in the last slide, with mini as a derivational prefix. We've also got borrowing. And then the third one, which we're really only briefly touching on today, but to which I would like to return in the next lecture, is another internal source, namely grammaticalization or lexicalization. If you want to get some water, that's fine. Okay, before you... Okay. Yeah, so as I said, only touched on today, just very quickly... to give you an example of something that is the result of grammaticalization, and that's got to do with the question of whether it's a new word or not. Is gonna a word? Can I have a show of hands? Who would feel that gonna is a word? Okay, a few people are quite happy with that. Yeah. Where does it come from? Well, I am going to London, you can say. Okay, you are physically moving to London. You can also say, I'm going to work in London. Okay, where the going to work in London is actually ambiguous. It is actually ambiguous between whether you're physically moving to London or whether you're going to in the future. So where going to is a marker of futurity, work in London. It's no longer ambiguous if you look at the sentence here. I am going to like London. Okay. Where going to is now clearly a semi-modal, and where it has the future, where it has the function of being a future marker. I'm going to miss London. Okay. I'm going to miss London. You can say. You can also say in connected speech, I'm gonna miss London, and increasingly. Depending on the text type, you might find this in writing too. But you can't say, I'm gonna London. Yeah? So quite obviously, something has happened here. It's the same words. It's something that's been fused. It's something that's become, well, lexicalized, grammaticalized, univerbated is another term, so of two words becoming one word. And it has, well, become a grammatical element. It marks future. Now, but originally, it was basically marking a literal physical movement. This is, on the one hand, a semantic change. The meaning has changed. But of course, we've also got a new grammatical meaning or a new way to express the grammatical meaning. So in a way, semantic change and grammatical change overlap, and that's also why I'm going to finish this lecture on... by talking about regularities, because many of these regularities will be much more visible in syntactic change. Okay, what's a new word? How do you define or how do you decide that something is actually a new word of the language? Belongs to the lexicon. Well, frequency is an obvious indicator. I showed you that there were about 27,000 words that occurred 100 times or more in the BNC. That's frequent enough to say that something belongs to the lexicon. If you have a new word entering the language and you'll see it used again and again, that's a good indication that it is now part of the lexicon. What the threshold is a good question again. There's also a term commonly used in this context, institutionalization. It must be somehow integrated with a particular form and meaning into the existing stock of words as a generally acceptable. In generally acceptable, of course, frequency comes to play again, and current lexeme. Now, in the case of borrowings, this can actually be quite interesting, because what happens there is that typically, well, this institutionalization goes hand in hand with some kind of nativization. Here's the term nativization again. It's not structural nativization as I used it when I was talking about the development of new forms, new syntactic structures in new Englishes, but it's in a way similar in the sense that it becomes adapted to the local way of speaking. Okay? So for example, by being integrated into the morphological system of the language. I'll give you an example of that in a minute. We will, of course, also have lots of situations, particularly in bilingual situations, where there is so-called code switching. Okay. Many of you will have experienced this, where sort of second-generation immigrants sort of switch back to their the language of their parents, perhaps only individual words, for various reasons. Many of you might be doing this themselves. I do it with English, because there are certain words which I'm more familiar with in English, and it's got to do with my, well, in this case, it's probably got to do with language competence, but it's also done, of course, for marking the kind of, well, kind of marking of social belonging. A lot of in-group talk is done by this. I'm a young, immigrant, teenager belonging to this subgroup of a particular culture, and I am happy and proud of this, so I show this by belonging also linguistically to a subgroup that uses code switching. Okay. That's not got all that much to do with the lexicon, so I'm not going to go into this, but I'd like to give you a brief example just to show the difference between borrowing and code switching. I do this usually with a letter that's written by a Malaysian to a Malaysian. This is how it starts. It starts very sort of straightforward, standard English. After my trip to the US and Canada, I went broke almost immediately, etc. So she tells what's going on there. And I asked for a supplementary credit card from my uncle when I applied for my US visa. I got it and was supposed to use it only if I get stranded somewhere between Kota Kinabalu and Vancouver. Fine. But then, of course, she starts to use it when she gets there, and she suddenly switches into, in this case, Malay. But, well, when I got there, I just signed, okay? And I have to check myself. Oh, yeah, cerita is story. So the story is when I get back to Kota Kinabalu, I immediately asked for the statement from Amex, and then I went to the bank and to get some money. Terus, I have to check my ASL. And to pay my uncle. Okay. Oh, it hurt when I see my bank account balance, etc., etc. Okay. But it's much better than being in debt, no matter how bankrupt you are. This is not borrowing. This is switching of code between different codes. In fact, it starts, some of it is Malay, but then Pukai, for example, or I don't know how to exactly pronounce it, is actually Chinese. Okay. It's not Mandarin, but it's one of the local dialects or one of the other dialects of Chinese. So this is, it's written, but they do it in spoken language as well, even much more so, of course. And it is a switch between different languages, different codes in this sense, and it is not in any way the other languages are not in any way integrated at all. What do I mean by integration or nativization? Well, for example, do you know what a Festschrift is? A Festschrift is a thing that academics produce. When famous professor turns 60 or 65, maybe on the occasion of retirement, then good friends get together and say, we'll give him a Festschrift. Okay? We'll all write a paper, we'll put it together, and he or she will be given that on the occasion of the birthday And that's called a Festschrift. German word that has been integrated into English. It's an official English word. What's the plural of Festschrift? Festschriften? No. Festschrifts. Yeah? Because it has become fully integrated in that sense. Not fully, of course. It's a fairly rare word. But if you talk about several Festschriften as an English person, you do not use the plural Festschriften, but you use the plural Festschrifts, and you're perfectly fine doing that. So in that sense, it's become part of the lexicon. You'll also find things like phonological nativization. This is something which I think I mentioned in the introductory lecture as well. Words like cul-de-sac, which are not pronounced. I mean, the French word is not cul-de-sac, but something like cul-de-sac or something like that. Okay, because the English can't say ü. Or durchkomponiert, which is also an English word, but of course not pronounced this way in English, but probably something like durchkomponiert or something. I don't know. So clearly, words like Munich as well have sort of been phonologically nativized. In fact, there is also something sometimes happening which can result in fairly odd, for people who know both languages, funny situations. Where are our native speakers? I think I saw one. Wait a minute, where are you? Where's the native speaker group? Oh, up there, yes. Do you know this word? How do you pronounce it? Coup de grâce, yes, okay. Is anyone a good speaker of French? What's a coup de grâce? Coup de grâce, yes. And what's grâce? Is fat, yes. Okay. So, or fat. Is it a blow of mercy? Or is it a blow of fat? Okay. This is some kind of hypercorrection. People know something about the French, and very often the S at the end is not pronounced, etc. So they seem to think, well, it's probably not pronounced. Okay. And then they actually produce something quite regularly, which has been in that sense adopted into the lexicon, not really phonologically nativized, but basically been sort of wrongly taken over from the point of view of pronunciation, meaning something completely different. Well, of course, in the English context, meaning the right thing, but for the French, not quite. Okay. Right. Aspects of borrowing. We might, of course, have direct borrowing, but we might also have borrowing via different languages, where the same word is first borrowed into Latin, from there into Old French, and then only enters English as part of the Norman conquest. Yeah. We might also have the same word being borrowed at different times, resulting in related words, but very different words. Okay. Some of them are related in meaning, but others are not. They are all dependent, or they are all from the same Latin word, but they were borrowed at different periods of the language. Another result of borrowing at different times that can be seen in present-day usage is the way English speakers produce the CH, the grapheme CH, in French loans. If we have old French words that were borrowed in Middle English as a result of the Norman conquest, then it's chief, chance, change, charge, check, etc. If we're talking about words that were added Renaissance or in modern English, either early modern English or late modern English, then it's not chef or chauffeur or something like that, but it's chef or chauffeur or chic or machine. Okay. So depending on when it was borrowed, you will have a different realization of the same graphemes. Another aspect of borrowing is more structural, and I think I may have mentioned this before in the introductory lecture a while ago. A calque is also a type of borrowing. It's a loan translation. It's when a term or a whole construction is word by word in a very literal fashion translated. What's the direct translation of Übermensch? Superman, yes. This is a straight translation from German. Weltanschauung, worldview. Okay. Or in fact, gospel. Yeah. This goes back to good spell, okay, good news. It's got nothing to do with God, well, lexically, yeah. But is a straight translation from, I mean, word by word, calque from Greek. Okay, what kind of words are borrowed? Well, we have made a distinction between open class and closed class words, and of course, the open class words are much more likely to be borrowed. Remember that I made a point about the fact that the Scandinavians introduced some pronouns into the lexicon, and I said that this was very unusual. Why is this unusual? Well, if you think about it, and we will think about that in the next lecture, how are new elements of grammar created? Are they just there, or how do words become part of the lexicon that have a grammatical function? We already saw going to, which evolved from something literal, and as I said, next time we'll be looking at this in a bit more detail. Is it only words that are borrowed? Well, yes, in a way. I mean, we can sort of, it's a bit of a nitpicking comment, really. In English, many of the original, much of the original writing can be preserved, and in that sense, you could say graphic elements might be borrowed as well, but I'm not completely convinced that this is an extremely important aspect of borrowing. Morphemes, are they borrowed? The X is the plural in this case. This is not like Festschrifts, okay, where the French plural is actually borrowed along with it. Is this a real borrowing? Well, in a way, no, because it's as if two different words were borrowed. It's not a productive process. It's not integrated into the morphological structure or morphological system of the language. So here, with those two terms, or with these two types of borrowing, I'm not so convinced. But there are also other things that are borrowed where I'm quite convinced that this is an aspect of borrowing. Phrases. We have, in fact, particularly again from French, quite a few phrases that are words that are clearly separate words in French that have become expressions that you can use in English, particularly if you want to pretend to be particularly well-read or be a little bit obnoxious or something like that, then you can do this. Okay. So what's happened here is that the whole thing has been borrowed as a phrase. In fact, it could be whole clauses or sentences. In English, you can say, je ne sais quoi. Okay. I don't know, would you say that? But you can hear it. Yeah. So it's something, as I said, I mean, a very small group of people would do this, but in that sense, it is something that you can make use of. So they're really treated as units. And in fact, in some way, we could say that they're treated as if they were words, because they are no longer seen as individual lexical items in a language that could be combined differently. There is no way an English person would make any change here. While, of course, a French person could, I don't know, my French is not good enough, but could, I'm sure, alter this. Okay. In fact, this may lead to an important question. What is really in the lexicon? Hi, how are you? Fine, thanks. How many words is this? Is this sort of, hi, how are you, four different words? Or don't we say this often enough to, in a way, be able to retrieve this perhaps as a whole unit? Also, fine, thanks. Fine, thanks. Well, yes, two words, but on the other hand, very, very frequent as a response. Nice weather today, isn't it? You're looking great today. That idiot of a driver almost killed me. You must be joking, etc. All of these are, well, I don't know about the idiot of a driver, but many of the others are actually expressions or sentences or words, question mark, that we use quite often. And there is a very influential paper by Paul Yensider which looks at this in more detail and also asks about how we acquire things like that and how we perhaps as second language learners or foreign language learners do not acquire these, as they call them, lexicalized sentence stems. It's been a long week again. Some people actually don't like the term lexicon. They call it the inventory. The inventory which could actually consist of larger chunks which might be retrieved as single units. Okay, just before the mini break, I'd like to do a quick run through word formation purely as a reminder, and then, as I said, in the second part of the lecture, I'll move on to semantic change. Okay. Very, very quickly, we've seen affixation, okay, adding affixes to another word, and they can be prefixes or they can be suffixes. Fine. Remember, prefixes in English are always derivational, suffixes can be inflection. Okay. When you're subtracting elements, usually actually they're affixes to form another word. This is a different way of introducing it, but then we're talking about back formation. In a way, it's the opposite of derivation. It's just that it's never happened. It relies on a process, or it assumes that a process of derivation or affixation has happened, but it didn't happen at all. So to laze from lazy, laze is a word which didn't exist first and then people became lazy, but lazy was first and it was assumed that laze was the original word even though it wasn't. To burgle is not the lexeme that was used to make burglar, but burglar was first and it looked like a word that was formed on the basis of derivational morphology, and therefore to burgle was formed. And in fact, words like pee, which goes back to Latin, is a back formation as well. The singular. Okay. We have compounding. I don't need to say much about that. Headhunter, greenhouse, spoon feed. Using one part of speech as another. Well, functional shift, conversion. A house can be used as a verb, to house, convict to convict, bottle to bottle up, and things like that. Okay. Fusing up elements, blending. We've got smoke as a combination of smoke and fog, brunch, etc., etc. I talked about these briefly before. We have different types of shortening, clipping. We also have something that I haven't mentioned before, aphesis or aphoresis, as some people call it, aphoresis. Venture is from aventure, okay? Loan from alone. So the dropping of one or more vowels at the beginning of a word. Okay, so that was just a brief reminder. If we look at the different word formation processes, and I have to admit now, I'm not sure whether I've shown this slide to you before if yes, but I don't think so. I'm not sure. If we look at the difference between present day word formation and Middle English, Early Modern English, and Old English, then we see different preferences for different types of word formation. I talked about the fact that compounding was extremely common in Old English. It was less important in Middle English. In Middle English, affixation is very frequent, but less so in Old English, etc. And some of them are really very low. Okay, the last few points about the lexicon. I did talk about register differences in the first semester. You will also have heard about register variation in the second semester, I hope. Here is a nice example which I sometimes give people in this context. Humphrey, this is from Yes, Prime Minister, which many of you will know. Humphrey had said that the relationship, which I might tentatively venture to aver, has not been without a degree of reciprocal utility and even perhaps occasional gratification, is approaching the point of irreversible bifurcation and, to put it briefly, is in the propinquity of its ultimate regrettable termination. I asked him if he would be so kind as to summarize what he'd just said in words of one syllable. He nodded and said, in sad acquiescence, I guess, "I'm on my way out," he explained. Okay, so it's clearly a case of the lexicon to make the first way of saying things more formal rather than just basically saying, well, in words of one syllable, "I'm on my way out." Remember, register is a subset of language used for a particular purpose in a particular social setting. And this has got to do with how we order the lexicon. We have common terms, the prototypical uses, one could say, the basic terms. And then there are more scientific uses of the same concept, more foreign, more sort of informal slang, more technical, more dialectal. Just to give you an example, pregnant is sort of the common one, up the spout. Okay. That's something that a doctor would say. This is sort of if someone wants to be very foreign, or perhaps again a little bit, I don't know, special, knocked up, gravid, obstetric, etc. You can see they're all terms which relate to the same meaning, but give away indications of, well, level of formality and register. Okay. One could do this differently. This is unfortunately too small for you to see. Again, it's a central or neutral word. We've got archaic ways, new ways, colloquialization, or higher academic. This is basically a different way of sorting things. And mad, which is sort of the common one. Well, you can say crazy, daft, loony, potty, batty. Okay. Or mental, unhinged, demented, possessed, insane, neurotic, psychotic, unbalanced, bananas, bonkers, crackers, round the bend of one's chump. And you can see how, depending on where you are on the circle, you really talk about different types of register where you would find the use of these terms. Of course, the register is defined through the lexicon, but in a way also the kind of lexicon that you apply will, of course, indicate the register or will be linked to that. It's a give and take. Okay, 2 minutes, mini break. Okay, let's continue. Oh, by the way, the last two lectures are now finally online. I did have some technical problems. I've now found a way of making them a bit better quality, the third and the fourth lecture. It's also a different format. If you're having trouble with this, let me know. I simply can't manage to change the first two, it seems, because I did some recording of... I played you some recordings as well, short clips. And for some reason, as soon as I start converting the format, all I get is Catman's hymn as the sound. And that's not quite what we want. So I'm still trying to find a solution for that, but let's see. Okay, remember, semantics is the study of meaning. And what we did in the introductory lecture was look at things like lexical semantics. We looked at sense relationships. We looked at words that have, for example, a synonymous relationship to each other or a near synonymous. We looked at different types of meaning, denotation, connotation. We looked at social meaning, etc., etc. We also, and that's in a way the same thing, I mean, we looked at how the words are ordered with respect to each other in what presumably is our mental lexicon. I also briefly mentioned how people looked at options for distinguishing between different words by, for example, introducing semantic features. So a man is an adult male, and a boy is a plus adult, but no, minus adult, but plus male, etc., things like this. Or I introduced the concept also of prototypes. A robin is a more prototypical bird than an ostrich or a penguin. The question is now, for the rest of the lecture, how do these things change over time? Okay. And a few related questions. First, two observations just to start your thinking. This is actually something, I mean, semantic change is something that is quite noticeable. And you can talk to almost anyone, and they will be able to give you examples of words that have changed almost during their lifetime, or at least their parents will use it differently from the way they use it. Just to give you a typical example, what does the word gay mean? Well, 50 years ago, it meant something very different, sort of cheerful, happy, etc., from what it means in most contexts today. Okay. So this is something very noticeable, and people also have opinions about this sometimes. Okay. Some people don't like, many people don't like change anyway, and particularly not semantic change. Okay. Also not syntactic change, but anyway. Okay. And then the other observation, which was often voiced, is that semantic change seems to be largely irregular, or, as it says here, unpredictable. It doesn't really make sense why, for example, mint and money have to do with the Latin word monere, to warn, admonish, or advise. Can anyone make sense of this? Well, you need to know more about it. I didn't know this either, but money in ancient Rome was produced near a temple of Juno Moneta, Juno the Admonisher. So, I mean, that's nothing that's sort of regular in the sense that was predictable. It's by chance, basically, that it was done there. Yeah. We will, as I said, later on, towards the end, ask the question whether there are some regularities. Now, when people do look at semantic change, then there are basically, there are three ways of looking at things. Okay. This is a bit more technical, but I guess the principle is very clear. The first way of looking at things is if you have a particular form-meaning pair, so a lexeme, yeah, what changes does the meaning undergo? Okay. How does the change? How does a particular word change its meaning over time? This is what could be called a semasiological approach. semasiology is a discipline that's concerned with the question, what does the word X mean? Okay. So the form is kept constant, and the focus is on how the word develops different meanings over time. To give you an example, the word sanction has changed its meaning from approve or authorize to impose a penalty. Not only, okay, you can still sanction something and approve it, but nowadays the more common meaning, one could check this in the corpus, is to impose a penalty. So the form hasn't changed, but the meaning has changed. You could also do the opposite, so to speak. Given a conceptual structure C, given some kind of concept, yeah, or meaning M, what lexemes can it be expressed by? This would then be an onomasiological approach. The focus is on, as it says here, restructuring of coded representations of a particular domain. So, we have a particular color or a particular concept. Yeah? And we can then check how this particular concept is expressed possibly by different forms over time. And the third one really looks at things almost from the outside and looks at how things happen given the fact that these things happen not just once. In other words, are there regularities? So given a conceptual structure, what paths of semantic change can be found to or from this conceptual structure? Not just in the case of one word, or one conceptual structure, but looking at things more in a more abstract way, how do these changes exhibit common features? So the change from a temporal to a conditional meaning, we could do this in different, we could have different ways of expressing temporal expressions, and they would then turn into conditional ones, or temporal towards concessive. Yeah. And again, this is sort of the more abstract way of looking at it, and that's where the question of regularities come in. I'll be looking at the first two for a moment, and then end with an outlook on regularities. So I'll give you, in other words, the classical story now. What can change in a word? Well, for example, the range of meaning. And there are different ways in which this can happen. And some of these you will have heard in the introductory lecture. Generalization or extension or broadening or widening or whatever you want to call it. And in fact, I'm going to give you a couple of examples from different languages just to show you that we're talking about something that's not just restricted to English, but that's actually a common feature of semantic change. Also, I've used one or two or several of these slides on sort of the classical story in a course that I taught in Lancaster, which was sort of the Department of Linguistics rather than only English, and there were also people who were interested in other languages. So some of these examples come from that use. For example, the Dutch examples, etc. To arrive, if you look at how arrive is made up internally, you will see that the river, the word river in a way is in there. So ad ripa, shore, okay, come to shore. So in a way, to arrive has been extended or generalized or broadened in meaning from just basically arrive on the on a boat, I guess, to just arrive in general. Dog was actually quite specific to start with, and now is basically a general dog. If you look at Dutch, it's not the case. They use the same word in Dutch as we use in English, in German, Hund, basically. There is an English word, hound, yeah, but that's much more restricted. So it seems that Dutch and German and English have gone different ways there, with very, very similar vocabulary. So in these cases here that you see on the slide, we're talking about a broadening or an extension. Of course, as we've just seen with the example of hound, we can have the opposite. We can have a restriction or specialization or narrowing. Okay. What's a girl? Well, actually, that's an interesting question. What is a girl? If we take the prototypical meaning, young female human being, okay, young female person, yes, okay, then that's the modern meaning. Actually, if you go and look in Middle English, then it could be applied to any young person. So it's been more restricted. Actually, girl is interesting because if you think about it, what is a girl? How old does a girl have to be in order to be a girl? You can talk, and I may have mentioned this in the introductory lecture already, you can talk about the girl behind the counter. Yeah? So girls can be 40 or 50 years old in that, well, yeah? Simply because you're talking about a particular type of, I don't know, person in the shop. So the meaning of girl isn't quite clear. But that's not really what this is about. This is about the general restriction from the Middle English girl to today's use, today's prototypical use of girl. Okay? And there are others in the list here where we see a restriction of meaning. We might also have change, and again, you may have heard these, you will have heard these before, to mean something to change the meaning in a way that it means something more negative. Okay. What does Latin sinister mean? Left. What is sinister today in English? It's something negative. Okay. Latin, puta, girl. French, putain is not just girl, okay, it's prostitute. Spanish as well. Crétin in French meant Christian, nowadays stupid. Okay. So clearly, pejoration. Yeah. And there are other examples. Again, an example of semantic change of a particular type. The opposite. Latin casa, hovel. Well, house is better than a hovel, right? The example that I've given you already is Knecht, which meant boy, and nowadays, or actually already in Middle English, came to mean gentleman and then a member of the nobility. Okay. Remember that I think I mentioned Knecht being related to today's German Knecht, where it has kept the more negative or more base description from the point of view of social status. Another way to look at semantic change is how things get changed in the context of metaphor and metonymy, okay? Mapping of one concept to another. I've given you the example of foot before, I think, the lowest part of the body, the lowest part of a hill, where basically one is, projected is, I guess, the best word, or mapped onto another element in the topography of the environment. Space towards time is actually also a case of metaphor, because something that is before, okay, which meant originally in the 17th century in front of, turns into something temporal. Okay. It makes sense because if you think about it, before, I mean, whether something is before something, and when you then move from one place to the other, it takes time. So conceptually, they are related. That was metaphor. Okay. We also have metonymy. Contiguity is a difficult term, but it basically means that there is some kind of connection, contiguity of meaning here. We have, this is what's usually the case, an association of one word with the other. So typical examples are things like the White House or the Crown. Okay, there are different types of metonymy. Let's not go into detail. pars pro toto and others, etc. But I'd like to give you a really brief interlude on an interesting interesting word, namely the word silly, which I think I briefly mentioned already in the overview, where silly, of course, is related to selig. Okay. And I'll give you some examples. Well, that's the original meaning, where it meant blessed. Okay. These are examples from the OED. This will have been around 1200. The example is actually from a little bit later, but the original meaning, the first use, will be from around 1200. Okay. Oh, Jesus, blessed is that abbey, and silly is that region. Blessed is that region. Okay. It then moved on to innocent and harmless. Okay. Alas, he said, this silly animal, this harmless animal, that does not do anything amiss. Okay. Then we have depriving of pity or sympathy. Silly Scotland, pitiable Scotland, okay, which is in great need of help. Then it moved on to physically weak or feeble. Okay. Here we see that a small, silly bird knoweth how to match with so great a beast. Then this kind of physical weakness was extended to intellectually weak and therefore ignorant. The silly herdman, all astonished, stands. Okay. And then finally, by the 16th century, so at the beginning of early modern English, we arrive at today's meaning of foolish. In pride we speak it, or at least inwardly think it, we are not as those silly idiots are. So, if you compare the beginning and the end, we've got a drastic change, no question. But if you think about it, then the individual steps are not drastic at all. These examples, I mean the examples in the book, are taken from a former colleague of mine, Willem Holman, and his Introduction to Semantic Change, in the Lancaster textbook that we wrote together as a department. And here is what he writes. Thus, blissful, blessed, is not that far removed from innocent or harmless. More precisely, blissful or blessed people and things are often also innocent and harmless, and again, a particularity in a medieval mindset, vice versa. So you can see the connection there. And there was thus some overlap between the categories of blessed, blissful people and things, and innocent, harmless people and things. Okay. Speakers may have reinterpreted utterances about, for example, a blessed religion as statements about a harmless religion. The same reinterpretation may have driven the next step. Innocent and harmless people, or things, often deserve our pity and sympathy. Moving on, we can say that if people think or things are deserving our pity and sympathy, this will often be because they are too weak to stand up or maintain themselves, either physically or through the use of their intellectual abilities. And people who are ignorant may, of course, display behavior that others consider foolish. And there we are. So each individual step is really a case of metonymy, contiguity, in the sense that one concept leads to the other one, but the result is, of course, a dramatic jump. But it's not a jump at all. It's basically a gradual moving where in the middle we have options for reinterpreting it either as a new meaning or making sense of it as an old meaning. And in that sense, we can see how something like blessed, and being rather foolish actually makes perfect sense as two parts of a very long chain of developments. Okay, let's return to the classical story, the causes of the change. There are, of course, external causes as well. Things happen in history, social, cultural, technological, we need new terms. Okay. This is very, very closely linked to changes in the history of mankind, so to speak.
speak.
So pen meant originally feather because that's what you use to write. Okay. Nowadays it doesn't mean feather anymore. Okay. These are interesting in themselves, but perhaps more interesting from a sort of processes or mechanisms type of view is the internal or linguistic changes. For example, if we look at French, we can see that the word casa, house, okay, or hovel, whatever, developed into chez, which is a preposition, at or in this place or something like that. You can see how they are related, yeah? I think, conceptually, at the house. Yeah? And the new word was therefore needed because, well, the word for house got lost. Okay, and that's, in a way, like a vacuum that needed to be filled. One could imagine it like that. And that's, in the sense, an internal change that needed to happen. There's also something known as grammaticalization. Okay. I wouldn't like to mention this much further now because I'm going to concentrate on that next time. But those of you who know some French will know about something that's been called Jespersen's cycle, namely the way that negation is used in French. How do French people negate? Je ne sais pas. We've got ne and pas, and they are both part of the official sort of negation. But what does pas actually mean? It means step. So originally pas meant a literal step. Nowadays it's become also part of negation. And in fact, in colloquial French, you can say je sais pas. So in other words, something that literally meant step has now become the sole way in informal speech of marking negation. This is by a process of that's called grammaticalization. I will mention that, as I said, next time in more detail. Here's a nice word for you. This is something that also leads to change and which is also internal. Homonymophobia. I'll let you work that out yourself. Okay. What's a homonym? Two completely unrelated words that sound and look alike, but do not mean the same thing. Okay. And if you've got that, in a way, you can see. I mean, this is a question of economy, in a way. You've got two words that this is confusing. Okay. And it seems that this also leads to change, then at least one of the two will change. Okay, I worked it out for you now, but anyway. Other changes. Psychological, other reasons, sorry, psychological. There seems to be a tendency to be expressive. Okay, there's also a tendency to be lazy. That's why going to becomes gonna. Or no. I'm a hit you. Yeah? I'm going to hit you. I am going to hit you. It's much easier to sort of say I'm a hit you if you're American, I guess. Not so much in British English yet. So laziness is one thing, but expressiveness is another one. And there seems to be a tendency to use certain terms to be expressive or to exaggerate, to emphasize, etc. Also, taboo comes in, which is basically an avoidance of mentioning certain terms. Just to give you an example of intensification, what does very mean? Well, originally, it was an adjective it meant true, and you've got vrai in English, in French. I think I've mentioned this before. Nowadays, it means very, well, it intensifies things. There are many others which express the same kind of need to intensify, to become more expressive, terribly, wickedly, etc. Terribly has nothing to do with terror anymore. It's just terribly good. Okay. To give you an example of taboo coming into change, if you look at the Russian word for bear, Medvedev, okay, I think that's how you would pronounce it. Or Medvedev? No, Medvedev, yeah. Honey eater, okay. You don't say something, it's not good to say the word bear, so you describe it differently to avoid mentioning the name. Okay. So that's in a way related to psychological reasons. The problem is, these different types which I've just given you, the different reasons, be they internal or, well, extension or all these other ones, they're not mutually exclusive. Sometimes two can apply, and that makes them difficult to use them as a kind of system that makes sense. Also, as I've said before, semantic change seems to be able to go in any direction. Okay, so it's a theoretical problem. It's just not very nice to abstract from those kind of things. But in fact, in recent years, people have begun to realize that there is much, much more regularity. Okay. Elizabeth Traugott is an important name in this context. She's looked at a lot of changes, both grammatical but also semantic, and she has seen that, for example, one of the tendencies in language change, in semantic change, but also in syntactic change, is that things become more subjective, more expressive of speaker attitude, more expressive of what I, as a speaker, think when I utter a particular word. If you think about it, very, whether something is true or whether I express how intense something should be interpreted, well, true is just basically, it can also be an interpretation, of course, but something that is very is something that expresses my attitude towards. So very good is more indicative of my attitude. When we left, it was threatening to rain. Threatening to rain? Threatening is, well, an evaluation on the part of the speaker. It promised to be a good day. This is different from the standard meaning of promise. It has developed more speaker, more expressive meaning for the speaker. People have realized that this has got to do with our cognition, basically. Language and cognition are very strongly interrelated. The way we use our language, the way our system of language is said to have some influence on the way we can, well, basically talk about what things are about us. But some people actually go as far as to claim that our language has an influence, or the system that we have has an influence on whether we can see differences or not at all, or express differences. This is basically going back to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which has been much criticized. Basically saying that, for example, if a language doesn't have a certain tense, people will find it more difficult to realize what the difference between, let's say, future and past is. This is a very strict or very direct relationship between language and cognition that nowadays is no longer followed. But there is a connection between the way we order things and the way we think about things. So we communicate about the contents of our minds, about mental representations, mental states, and mental beliefs. And semantic change, basically, is a change in those mental categorizations. So, in a way, it's a cognitive process that we're talking about. And, well, subjectification, which is the term that's used here, isn't really, in that sense, only in the language. It's actually a cognitive process. So, for example, we see in the objective word that there are signs of impending rain. Okay. but we make a subjective construal out of it by interpreting it as bad news, and therefore the attitudinal element of threatening to rain comes in. This will have been fairly abstract. Things like that will become more clear when I introduce grammaticalization and other mechanisms of syntactic language change next time. I'd like to say a few words about the assignment now. I will be uploading a fairly long description of the tasks. Okay, I've got a copy here, it doesn't help you, but that's what it looks like. Okay, it's required for sixth semester BA, BA Nebenfach, or BEd students. Okay, there is a bracket missing there, sorry. Okay. It's recommended or an option for people that are exchange students, for example, and want quite a bit extra points. Okay. If you do the exam at the end, that also gives you points, so it's an option for you to increase the points that you get for this lecture. If you're a fourth semester student, you can basically go home now, but it doesn't apply to you. But I'll finish in 2-3 minutes anyway, so let's not all get up, please. You're getting 2 credit points for this, and if you know what a credit point means, it actually means that it translates into twice 30 hours of work. Okay, so it's actually a fairly substantial amount of work. I don't think it's going to take you 60 hours. Okay, but let's see. And in fact, I would like to give you 2 options, and they have to do with an analysis of individual words. And writing down the analysis, basically. It's some sort of mini paper. It's not a full paper. You don't have to do the full, follow the full structure and anything of a normal paper, but it's some kind of mini report on something that I would like you to do that's related, in fact, to the lexicon in many ways. This is similar to what Professor Stubbs is asking for in his lecture. He's asking for a 4-page report on something to do with the topic that he's talking about. So I'll give you 2 options. The first is to present an analysis of 2 or more near synonyms, both in present-day English and the history of English. Okay. And to look at their development, you could, for example, take words that are, well, one of them Latinate and one of them Anglo-Saxon, and then see how they have developed over time and how they are used today. For this purpose, I very strongly recommend or encourage the use of electronic corpora. Okay, don't get scared. I know that many of you will have very, very little experience in this, but there is the other option which you can choose if you do not want to work with electronic corpora. Okay. The second one is basically work with the Oxford English Dictionary and other dictionaries. Okay. I would like you to look into different words or words that were introduced at different levels or different stages in the history. And in fact, I'd like you to look at 15 words each of 4 periods of words that were introduced in the 20th century, in the 17th century, the 14th century, and the 11th century. And I would like you to analyze their morphological structure and their meaning and things like that, and then tell me something about how this has changed over time and whether you see, for example, differences in the way words are formed, etc., etc. This is the first part. And the second part is that I would like you to analyze the word and the development of the word passion. Okay? Which is an interesting word. Okay. So you do either 1 or you do 2. If you do 2A and 2B, both of them, then you can fully work with dictionaries alone. The Oxford English Dictionary is available online. You can add corpus work there too if you want to, but you don't have to. With number 1, you would have to be willing to look at something like BNC Web and do a basic analysis there, which is fairly, I think, straightforward. And I wouldn't expect you to produce a sort of fully fledged corpus analysis. Don't worry about this. But it's basically about finding out developments in the lexicon. The deadline is late. Like in Professor Stubbs's lecture, it's the 12th of July. Okay. This gives me enough time, I hope, to look at it and to say, yes, that's fine, you can do the exam. Okay. I need to be able to check this because the assignment is part of the Studienleistungen that you need to fulfill in order to be allowed to take the Modulprüfung. Okay. Now, if you're selecting option one, then I would not like you to select just anything because there are synonyms or pairs of synonyms which are more likely or more easy to look at than others. For example, you might choose two words that are so infrequent that you don't find anything in the data. So I would like you to check the selection with me by June 15th if by email if you'd like to do this option. Okay. If you're not getting back to me by June 15th, I will assume that you're choosing option two. Okay. Make use of my office hour if you want. You can ask questions about using data, which data to use, etc. But basically the task is for you to do an analysis of some aspects of the lexicon in the history of English, and you should be equipped to do this now. Okay, a few minutes early. See you in 3 weeks' time, and enjoy the break.